everyone to the second coffee poetry reading aloud affair that we're giving tonight. First of all, I'd like to thank Espresso Roman and all the fine staff, and I'd also like to thank the staff at the University Bookstore for all this, the extra things they've done. Tonight's first guest is Linda Beers. She's employed at the University of Washington at the Women's Information Center, and she just has a new book published, The Stillness and the Dancing, published by Henry Holt. Henry Holt, in the 1920s and 30s, published books by young poet Robert Frost. 20 years ago, I introduced another poet, and we had an autograph party for her at this bookstore, and her name was Carolyn Kaiser. And 20 years later, she won a Pulitzer Prize. So perhaps this is your lucky night, Linda.
Hear me all right? Over there, too? Okay. Well, gives me something to look forward to in 20 years or so. I'd like to start tonight by reading a poem that I usually close with or read quite a bit closer to the ending of a reading. It's called Strike, and I want to just give you one little note about it, and that is that Strike is the area where an ascending plane intersects a horizontal plane. It's also, of course, the term people use when they find gold. Strike. First the salt was removed, then the axes and powder horns, the blankets, jerky, shot pouches, gourds, the kettles and muslin, the burlap torsos of cornmeal, and the wagons hauled on a coil of rope, hand over hand, up the last granite face of the High Sierra, dangling, wobbling fat in that wind like lake bass. Then the oxen pushed up the spidery trail. In the concave crooks of their shanks, the mules centered and pushed, and then it was all restored. Soon the nut pines yielded to scrub pines, the wind to the screams of the hand carts, wooden axles, wooden wheel hubs, day after day, the haunting wooden voices. Now and then, the lowland flashed up through the trees, russet and gold-filled. Ophir, mineral bar, the American River. Then the scrub pines gave way to the black oaks, the wistful manzanitas. On the bank of a river fork, someone knelt, pinched the gravel, plump and auriferous. Two others talked of their journey and the journey of gold, of their last descent and that climbing, fold fault and lifting, erosion, glaciation, explosion, the magma and silica scratching upwards, pin step by pin step to meet them. All night the rain washed over the wagons, cut down through the wheel ruts and fire pits, the powdery topsoil, as if to say deeper, just a little deeper, and in the morning pulled up in the muzzles of mules, dangling in the grassy root tips, that gold dust, that ending. The next poem is a journey poem too, this time over water. During the last century, Russian sailors wanted to explore the warm water islands, the Marquesas, and they thought that if they took boats along that were made by the people of the Aleutian Islands, they might be able to get into the shallow water. And these boats were called skin boats. They were like canoes, and they were sealskin and were washed with fat. And they didn't anticipate what would happen with the warm equatorial waters. The skin boats, 1830. Back from the pin-tipped eastern peninsula, back over the basin of podzols and black earth, forests and fodder crops, just outside the gates of St. Petersburg, a thin hound skimmed through the grasses, its bones almost hollow, weightless, its flapping weightless hair almost the grasses. And circled a little cheering crowd, those three in the foreground, sunburned and fattened, about to begin their trip back. The long land took the color of chestnuts. Ice buckled, broke, where the sea of Okhotsk curled under the Pacific. This year they would search the Marquesas. Snow squalls warming to vapor, oilskins abandoned, sweaters and high boots, the murmurs of livestock floating up through the deck boards as the sea turned slowly from slate to lime. A glisten then, on the lips and shoulders, on the shadowy skin boats lashed to the railing, brought on for the shallow waters, a loot boats, a shaving of whalebone, a sheath of seal hide, a wash of clear fat, and thrummed by the trade winds, the thin vessels trembled like reeds. Like ghost hummocks, someone said, then pointed beyond from his own plump sling, past his sleepy companions swaying from the deck poles, past the border of rippling skin boats to the stars. Wolf, centaur, hydra, and slowly the others began, tracing again the fabulous shapes, visible and not. Scorpion, raven, then a hand plow perhaps, perhaps a glove or larch tree, just over each face, the self with its jagged past, almost a constellation. With the motion of whales, the island surfaced, sank and surfaced, grew through one night to a green wall. The skin boats were lowered. Legs slipped through the glistening hatches, the glistening sheaths, turned gradually useless. Whale fat, the flat equatorial sun, then sea licking over the pulpy seams. They stroked for a moment, glided, stroked, glided, for a moment almost weightless, almost wind or sea turn, pale water, the crimson shore scrub brushing their shoulders, not otherworldly, but other, before the boats filled, the legs touched down. I'd like to read two or three that are sort of based on science at different times of our history. The first is an homage to Louis Pasteur and has to do with rabies and the treatment for rabies. That when someone is bitten by a rabid animal, it's counteracted by injecting into the person who's bitten a little bit of the brain of a rabid animal. And the more the fresher the brain is, the stronger the solution is. So you start with solutions that are much older and work your way toward the fresher ones. The brain that is used of the rabid animal to inject the victim is also used to control sound. It's the medulla, and it's part of the brain that's used to control sound. This poem is called Quickly and Fully. Not foam at all. certainly not froth, just a web of viscid gel, palate to muzzle. A squint, a gape, now and then a rush of high-toned howls, sharp, then diminishing. And where the candlelight offers its own web, a woman reads of this illness. One spark of germ, then the brain like a scarlet skullcap. Of the cure she will carry, those specks of red medulla dictating sound, flecked, injected, day after day, 2 grams of rabid animal brain flickering through her bloodworks. Not fury at all, a nudge. She had carried cold stones down the side path for the licking, the swollen tongue, and out from a break in the hedgerow, from a nest of string and balsa, that tongue nudging a hangnail. She gathers her gloves, little kerchief of biscuit and plums. It is dawn on the roadway to Paris. Already the chemists are working. All across the room, suspended from threads in cotton-topped vials, the daubs of drying medulla weight, row after row, tiny nerve hooks for hearing, the curl of the muzzle, used now for a madness turned back on itself. 10 day, 5 day, 1 day, to the strongest, far off in a corner, so plump they might still cup the impulse for sound. Like glass harps, she thinks, then takes the injection, quickly and fully, as she takes the grief, the little fear, then the joy of human wonder. Perhaps I will hear, as you did, for these days, the lost animal sounds. But she does not, of course, just wind and her shoes in the wheel ruts, the sluice of bitten plums. I became interested in current microbiology and went down to the health sciences complex to look at their electron microscope, and particularly in the current work on altering microbes that affect the formation of frost on crops. This poem is called April. A little wind, one creak from a field crow, and the plow rips a shallow furrow, hobbles from guide stake to guide stake, draws its first contour line and parallel, its next, next, then the turn strips and dead furrows, the headlands and buffer lines, until the earth from a crow's vantage takes the pattern of a fingertip. And by noon the shadows are gridways, cut soil, the man on the plow and simple tail, each squat on a stretch of slender shade, black and grid straight, like the line of anti-light a screen clicks up to, before its image swells, deepens. Dark glass going green, in the shade darkened room of a laboratory, it casts a little blush across the face there, the shoulders and white pocket, then magnifies the moonskin of a microbe, then deeper, electron molecules in a beam so stark it smolders. The man on the plow fears frost, its black cancer. The man at the screen fears the storm an atom renders on the lattice of a crystal, and heat, and the slick backlicks of vapor. With luck, with the patience the invisible nurtures, he will reshape frost-making microbes, snip frost-hook jeans with a knife of enzymes. And at 30 degrees, 20, through seam lines of snap beans, oranges, almonds, potatoes, no frost will form, no ratchet bite of ice. All the buds of transformed microbes blossoming, reblossoming like the first flowers. There is wind at the rim of the blackout shade. One tick of the focus gears, another. On a glass plate, enlarged from nothing to filaments, the lines of DNA wander, parallel, in tandem, curl together past pigment blips, resin, as the contour lines for autumn oranges swerve in unison past boulder pods. The light through the mottled skins of jeans is not light at all, but friction, caught and channeled, like pigment caught in the scratch marks of caves. This was our world, the marks say. Horse, maze, vast gods drawn down to a handprint. Drawn up from nothing, the microbes wait. A little wind on the curtain, sun on the curtain's faded side, on the crow and plow, on the earth sketched perfectly to receive it. Back in the time of Galileo, as he was discovering that the earth was not the center of the universe, quite a few people were having trouble with that concept and were trying to prove that it was, and that indeed the sun did revolve around the earth. One of them was Cardinal Bellarmine, who didn't have any particular scientific equipment, but would stand on the beach at night and try to gauge the velocity of the sun, because he knew exactly how long it would take him to chant certain prayers. He wrote a book called The Art of Dying Well, and this is the title of the poem, The Art of Dying Well. The sun slides toward the sea line to the roll of a Latin chant, a prayer sung by a cardinal on a beach in Italy. It is dusk, by the close of his last miserere night, and the sun will have run more than 12,000 miles. So a problem of science, of the Earth's fixed hub in the universe, has called him here, without plane or plumb bob, with only the timepiece of a measured chant and a backwash of fear. Galileo has opened a second heaven, soon a third, all his stars like pallid apples. The song and wave breaks spill, recede, float in their thick duet up over the beach grass, up through the windows of an eyeglass maker, now slowed with a similar fear. Could it be that the earth is a jester's tassel, spun round from a crown of tassels, that the ox and dogwood do not summon the light, but hasten toward it? His hands are parched with grinding sands, his eyes with the wheel's revolution, the glint stroke of glass spinning up from its thin refraction. How heavy his shoulders feel, his wrists and boot soles, and yet to be nothing, fluff circling round a candle. He stops, looks out to the sun, then the cardinal, who waits in his red robes so much like the sun, whose robes on the sand must offer a sound so much like the grating of glass. Then he closes his eyes, captures all three on his eyelid, glass, cardinal, sun, like a small constellation drawn back again. Okay, now the hard part. When Ivan and I were talking about doing this reading, we thought it might be interesting for you if each of us read a little of the other's work. In fact, Ivan's wife, Carol, thought it might be interesting for you if you heard this. And so I turned to Rascal Fair, which I know very well, but I was surprised to discover a certain section that shares so many images with a poem of mine that I wanted particularly to read it to you. Ivan didn't see the poem and I didn't see his book, so I can only think that some of these images have to be archetypal or something, but I'll read to you, oh, maybe four or five paragraphs of a little bit from the Rascal Fair, and then the last poem, and then Ivan can take over. What's happening here, two of the book's main characters, Angus and Rob, and Angus's son Varick, are going off into the deep winter to try to bring hay back for their cattle. They have sleds that are drawn by horses, and a storm seems to be welling. There's a lot of snow on the ground. We had our own tracks of yesterday to follow on the white plain west of Valir, smooth grooves of the sled runners and twin rough channels chopped by the horses' hooves. The Reese horses strained steadily as they pulled our hayloads. With every step, they were rescuing us a little more, drawing us nearer to Scotch Haven and out of this width of winter. All was silence except for the rhythm of the horses' labor, muscle against harness, hooves against snow. Existence crept no faster than our sleds, as if time had slowed to look gravely at itself, to ponder what way to go next, at what pace. I know I had thoughts, you can't not, but the lull we were traveling in held me. Keeping the team's leather reins wrapped in my mittened hands was the only occupation that counted in the world just then. The change in the day began soon after we were beyond Valir's outlying farms and homesteads, where our tracks of yesterday went on into the prairie of the Double W Ranch. At first, the mountain seemed oddly dimmed, as if dusk somehow had wandered into midday. I tried to believe it as a trick of light, all the while knowing the real likelihood. In front of me, I could see Varick letting only his hands and arms drive the team, the rest of him attentive to those dimming mountains. Behind me, Rob undoubtedly was performing the same. So the three of us simultaneously watched the mountains be taken by the murk, as if a gray stain was spreading down from the sky. The mountains gradually became more and more obscure until they simply were absorbed out of sight. We had to hope that the weather covering the western horizon was only fog or fallow cloud and not true storm. We had to hope that mightily. The wind, too, began faintly enough, simply a sift through the top of the snow, soft little whiffs of white dust down there. I turtled deeper into the collar of my sheepskin coat in anticipation of the first gust to swoosh up onto the sled at me. But a windless minute passed, then another, although there were constant banners of snow waving past the horse's hooves. I could see Varick and his sled clear as anything, but he and it seemed suspended in a landscape that were casually moving from under them. A brown blizzard, gentle enough so far, a breeze brooming whatever loose snow it could find, oddly tidy in its way. Another tease from the weather, but as long as the wind stayed down there at knee-high, we were out of harm. This last poem is called The White Ponies, and it is about the attempt of Commander R.F. Scott to reach the South Pole. The error that he made was in selecting white horses to pull his equipment. They just were not adapted to that particular terrain and couldn't complete the task. All of the men in the search party, all of the men in the exploration party died. The White Ponies, Commander R.F. Scott, born June 1868, died South Pole Exploration Party March 1912. No color at all now. and wind kicking up the snow to a blizzard. 4 men, 6 sleds, ponies so white they are nothing. A mistake, the leaders think, how the hooves slip and the clear, frightening bay scoots over the ice forever. He watches the reins shimmy, remembers his father far ahead on the bank of the Thames, an incredible tow rope looped over his shoulders like a harness. Pulled by that rope, how the skiff veered to the shoreline, while the boy inside pushed off with a birch stick, watched his father jog on, appearing, disappearing, as the river turned. And so, through memory, this landscape takes its texture, its color. There is coughing, the faint lisp of the runner blades. We have stood at the axis of the world, someone shouts, all boots pointing north, and a tug on the trousers like the undertow of the Black Sea. He laughs, looks over his shoulder at the others. And why do you climb the mountain, he teases, and why do you cross the road? Snow lessens, then sky returns with its white covering. Near death, a pony stumbles, and because there is no night here, for weeks now, months, the men just unroll their brittle pallets, rest in the open daylight. A little wind ruffles the weather bags. All the compasses in our hands just slackened, someone thinks, as if we were the source they were seeking. And how beautiful the ponies are, white outlines of the bodies appearing, disappearing on a backdrop of snow. For warmth, they graze over the resting men, who awaken now and then to the long faces, eyes fixed and liquid like roomy moons. Such wonder, someone calls, such curiosity we contain to be pulled by the likes of you. There is laughter. Behind clouds, the sun moves in its high arc over this region, without birds, without lichen or moss, without night. Over this landscape, this acceptance of nothing but light. From his pallet, the leader waits, watches the sky, the occasional interruption of an animal face, breath lifting up from the nostrils. Father, he thinks, when the shoreline turned, you were nothing, just steam, the rope held taut by steam. That's all.